Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. With dogs of every size, shape, and color, you might wonder how they can still be the same species. A new project tracing the genomic history of dog breeds may actually shed new light on diseases they share with humans. And from a recent conference about sustainable forest management, Aboriginal people lend their wisdom to new ways of blending traditional and Western scientific knowledge. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Genome Alberta recently hosted a conference at the Banff Centre, and among the researchers from across North America was Dr. Heidi Parker. She's with the National Institutes for Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Heidi and some of the other scientists in her lab have been tracing the genomic history of man's best friend.
Well, dogs are actually very exciting when we're talking about genetics. That if you think about dogs and dog breeds, it's sort of like a little genetic project that's been going on for maybe 1,000 years. That people who knew nothing about genes or chromosomes started doing, just looking at the dogs and saying, I want a certain trait, and I'm going to breed it in, and I know somehow that I can do this simply by making crosses and selecting for certain traits. And these are things that are done in the lab now with knowledge of the chromosomes, but were started with these dog breeders centuries ago.
And yet when you come right down to it, all dogs come back to, it's all one species, and yet there's so many different varieties or breeds. What is it that you're doing in your lab then to try and figure out the differences between or similarities between all of these dogs?
So that is something that's been very interesting to us. We're looking at these, we have some 400 breeds in the world, all with some slightly different trait, a slightly different look. And so what we're doing is looking at markers in the genome. We look at about almost 100 markers and compare them across these breeds and see how they share patterns, what are different between the breeds, which ones are the same, and this tells us how closely related each of these breeds are. And eventually we can put that information together to sort of build a family tree of dog breeds based on that.
Now, has it been difficult trying to do that when you compare it to other species?
Well, we haven't tried it in other species, but definitely some of this work has been done in mouse before where they have very specific histories and they can say exactly where a strain of mice comes from. With dogs, it is more difficult because there's been a lot of crossing, a lot of hybridization between breeds, and not a lot of this was written down necessarily when it was first done. So it all has to be traced strictly through the genetic information that we have.
So what have you found so far in terms of the different kinds, the different clusters?
So at this stage, we've looked at about 132 breeds. And as I said, there's 400 breeds out there. So we haven't covered everything there is available. But we've basically sort of determined that there are about 5 different clusters of dogs, different groups of dog breeds. One of these we call the ancient group of dog breeds. And this is dogs that come out of Asia typically, or sled-type dogs, dogs with that spitz-like appearance. One of them is a mastiff-type group. These are the very large, bulky, heavy-headed dogs typically used for guarding. Then we have a group of sighthounds based on the greyhound and some other of the tall, thin, chasing type dogs like that, a group of sporting dogs, pointers and setters, and a group that we call the mountain dogs, which are sort of these large flock guarding dogs that come out of the mountains of Northern Europe.
Have you found any surprises?
Well, one of the surprises was that there are a couple of dogs that are thought to be very ancient breeds that we find grouping in with some of the more modern breeds, something like Faro hounds or Abyssinian hounds that look very much like these dogs from the tombs of Egypt. And what we haven't been able to determine yet whether or not that is because some of these breeds have been recreated since their original founding, if they did come out of Egypt, or if it's because they are so old that they have been used in the development of the other breeds. And so it's sort of having a hard time sometimes with the timeline, how the different breeds group together. One of the other things that we have found out is that a lot of the times the very small breeds are very hard to place in where their cluster is. And I think some of that is because we don't know where they came from. They have been reduced now to their very small size that we don't know what their original function was. And if we see them grouping with a mastiff or if we see them grouping with a sporting dog, we think that just doesn't seem right because they don't hunt and they don't guard. But, of course, originally, perhaps in their past, they really did. And it was just hard for us to determine what their precise location is in all of those clusters.
Now, you focused a bit on diseases that are in dogs. What are some of the diseases that you've looked at?
So one of the things that we've concentrated very highly on in dogs is cancer. Cancer incidence in dogs is even higher than it is in humans. Some have suggested perhaps as many as 25% of dogs get cancer in their lifetime. And that's very large incidence. And some of the cancers that they get are the typical cancers that we see in humans, lymphomas, leukemias, various different soft tissue sarcomas. They get breast cancer, they get bladder cancer, things like that. So that has really been one of the focus of our research into disease in dogs. But at the same time, we're looking at Addison's disease, we look at various eye diseases. There are all sorts of things that we can pinpoint in different breeds.
There are some diseases, then, that are associated with certain breeds, and you don't find them in others. What have you found out that way, and what significance is that in terms of the mapping?
So that's very true. Most of the diseases, especially if it has a hereditary component, you'll find that there are some diseases, some breeds that have a high incidence, meaning most likely that there was a founder of that breed that had that disease, and so it was carried on within these sort of closed breeding boundaries that you have now. And other breeds won't get that disease at all. So this definitely helps us in the mapping because it helps us sort of narrow down the regions of the genome that we're looking at by looking at things that are shared within a certain breed that only carries that disease versus a breed that does not carry that disease.
Does that apply or carry over then to humans, since you say that we share some of these cancers?
Yes, definitely. Many of the diseases that we have mapped in the dog have been directly related to a human disease. There's been a matching human disease, and very often the same gene has been affected in the human. So we expect that to be the same case with the cancers as we find mutations in genes that affect the cancers as well.
Well, what does that mean then? If it's the same gene in a human as it is in a dog, how did that happen? How is it that we share the same genes?
So basically, all of us share the same genes. There are basic genes that just develop life. They develop cells. They show us how the cells work. They build proteins. And most of us, especially as mammals, we carry almost the exact same set of genes. So these genes are simply ones that are involved in making a cell, in the case of cancer, a cell replicate itself and continue to grow. And this happens in all species. It doesn't matter whether we're dogs or humans or mice. So the same genes can be in our cells that cause them to grow out of control is in a dog cell and will cause it to grow out of control as well.
What else are you going to be working on with this canine mapping?
So obviously with dogs, when we look at where we talk about breeds and we talk about all these little populations, the first thing that comes to mind is just simple morphology. Look at all of the different types, the different coats, the different ear types, face types, sizes, shapes. Those are things that definitely we're always interested in looking at. What causes all of that variety that we see, and can we pinpoint the genes that are involved in that as well?
Now, the methods that you've developed here, how can they be applied to other areas, say people who would be doing mapping in cattle?
Well, definitely, any case where there is a structured population like we're looking at in dogs, where there in dogs we have different breeds, in cattle you might have different breeds or different strains, they might have a different name, but there's definitely a group of cattle that are more related to each other than they are to the ones next door. And that group has a different set of genetic disorders than the other group. So you can apply the same mapping information by looking at these little structured populations to any population, probably even to humans. As we are, you know, sort of split up into our different geographic regions, we have these same sort of differences, background differences in our genome, and we can use this these methods there to look for diseases and mutations as well.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Heidi Parker. She's a research fellow with the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. She was in Banff at a conference on agriculture, genomics, and biotechnology, which was hosted by Genome Alberta. Earlier this year, the Sustainable Forest Management Network hosted its national conference in Edmonton. And among the many people who came to talk about their work in shaping a new vision for forestry in our country were those involved with the Pecanisham First Nation and the White Feather Forestry Initiative.
This is located in Western Ontario near the Manitoba border. Dr. Ian Davidson-Hunt is an assistant professor with the Natural Resources Institute at the University of Manitoba.
When I worked with them, we started a mapping project. So, you'd go out and you'd look and you'd say, what sort of the values on the land? What is it that, what are the opportunities? What sort of things do we want to protect? What sort of do we want to? So it was basically working with the youth so they could do their own mapping, working with their elders.
I understand that they actually won a first prize for the mapping they did.
The mapping has come a long way since 1995, and many of the youth took on the mapping and then got further training with other people and some people who are quite good at cartography, and eventually led the First Nation to win that prize and was entered internationally in a competition, which was another, and got honorable mention internationally.
Now, this White Feather Forest Initiative seems rather unique. What do you see being involved in all of this?
I think one of the key aspects of the White Feather Forest Initiative has been the involvement of the elders over time, and that they've become more and more involved. And Bikanishkam First Nation is unique in the sense that it has high language retention and had a high amount of people still on the land until relatively recent in their history. So I think in some ways that's allowed them to retain a lot of their own knowledge of the land and their own knowledge of how they want to do things and how they think about the land. And that's been they've been fiercely independent and haven't really wanted to take on things from the outside without sort of making those things part of their own process.
And how is that coming along from your perspective?
I think they've gone through a lot of hardship. They faced lots of opposition in the early days. They went up against the Minister of Indian Affairs at the time, who wanted to take the allocation that was within the White Feather Forest, and there was other people interested in that wood fiber. And so they've had a long fight with a number of parties, and they've had to really work for this project. It hasn't been something just came to them. They've gone through periods where they were cut off their funding from the federal government, and they've really struggled to achieve this. And I think at some point, because of their deep connection to land and sort of they maintain some of these philosophies, that out of this, there may come a time where there's a type of Aboriginal renaissance, that these new approaches are going to finally actually have a difference in how forests are managed on the ground.
One of the things that really impressed me in the presentation from Patty Peters was his very detailed description of what went into the designing of the symbols for the White Feather Forest Initiative, and how it encompassed the actual process, the thinking process that was behind the development of this initiative. It's incredibly sophisticated. I thought, boy, there's a lot to be learned here.
I think that in early days when we, and this is particularly coming out of natural resource management or forest management, I think when we started to work with Aboriginal people, we sort of looked for knowledge they held that was similar to knowledge we held. So do they know the location of where, a bear den is? Or do they know, where caribou calve? Or do they know? So it was always sort of what they knew, on the ground. And I think if we go to sort of some of the philosophies that they hold, and if we think that our own management is guided by our own philosophies, then some of what they're expressing, and I sort of think of this as the next, I don't know if it's next wave or a higher order way of trying to work with Aboriginal people, is that we really need to understand some of these philosophies that guide their actions on the land. And that's more than just sort of number counting. It's about having a different way to relate to other beings and to other humans, actually. So it's a very different way of understanding those things, and it is quite sophisticated and takes a long time to for us to understand it if we don't come from that background.
How has this changed your perspective on things?
Yeah, when I started, I came out of a, I'll say scientific background, but, you know, I had worked mostly in plants and plant breeding and sort of different characteristics of plant morphology and through a long process of working with indigenous people. In the early days, it was sort of what do they know? Well, what do they know about plants? Is how do they use plants and those sort of things? And I think now what I'm more curious about is understanding how they structure the relationships to other animals in a way that they think those animals can be sustained over time while they undertake things on the land. And that's a different starting point. So I realized that when you first hear, a lot of times when we first hear Aboriginal elders speak and we come out of this context, scientific context, and it's very hard for us to understand the messages that are being communicated. We understand the words, or we understand how it's being translated, but we don't really understand the principles that underlines what's being said. And once you start to get some of those things, it opens up whole other ways of understanding what they're talking about and what they're saying. And it really is a different way of doing it, and it provides some interesting alternatives, or at least some new ways of thinking about how we might manage resources.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Ian Davidson Hunt, an assistant professor with the Natural Resources Institute at the University of Manitoba. He's a researcher with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Also on hand to talk about the White Feather Forestry Initiative was Patty Peters. Patty is an Ojibwe from the Pekanisham First Nation.
In the past, our people were never really involved in any kind of development. I guess activities that our people were involved was traditional activities, hunting, fishing, trapping, gathering. And the only, I guess, money that was coming to our community was government monies to run our ban office, to run certain programs in the community, our education, our health services. But there was ever no money for our people to to make revenue. We were never involved in that. I guess the only area that we were involved was commercial fishing or seasonal firefighting. So our people seen what was happening south of us, and our people said we have to get involved. We can't continue to say no to development. If we continue to say no to development, we're going to be left behind. We're not going to be able to benefit from the resources on our lands. We have to do something about it. So this is where, you know, we began the land planning process that we have worked on for the past 10 years.
Now, your father-in-law spoke very well today, and you interpreted for him about how important the land and your way of your traditional way of life is to your people. So how are you going to be able to maintain your traditional way, maintain the land in a sense the way it is, and at the same time incorporate the development, because the development is going to take the trees away?
Yes, that's something that our elders have had discussed through this land planning process. I guess when you talk about forestry, the way that forestry has been done over the years in any area, I guess across Canada, it's been the same. It's cutting down all the trees, stripping the land, clear cutting an area. But our elders say there has to be another way of doing forestry. And this is what our elders are looking into right now. There has to be another approach to doing forestry without destroying the land. So with that in mind, our elders say we can do this new type of forestry, and at the same time, we will not destroy the land that we use to hunt or to trap or to fish.
You're putting an awful lot of work into the planning. You spent a lot of time today describing the process that your people are going through in order to come up with a plan that works for you and for your people. Could you tell me a little bit about what's involved in developing this process?
Well, first of all, it takes a lot of commitment from the community, from the people. It takes a lot of working time, a lot of your time, where you have sessions, deliberations in the community with the elders, and also it's not just in the community. We have to go outside the community level too to speak with the provincial government, MNR people, that are our partners on this project. So we have to come to the table to have dialogue. We have to tell them what we want to do on our lands. If we want to get into forestry, if we want to get into mining, if we want to get into tourism and recreation, this has to be all discussed. This has to all be planned, what we are proposing to do on our land.
What kind of research is taking place to help you understand, like, more about the animals that are there and the different resources that you have?
Well, a lot of the research that has been done over the years has been research that has been done by outside people, but there has never been any research that has been done that our people were involved in. So this kind of research we are very interested in, our people getting involved, especially our elders, accessing the knowledge of our elders to do this type of research. I think that way, when our people are involved, we can share the knowledge of the animals, of the land, of the birds to the outside community, the way that our people know that.
Your father-in-law spoke very eloquently in Ojibwe about the need to balance the two systems of knowledge, traditional knowledge and Western scientific knowledge. Could you elaborate on that?
What my father-in-law explained, Western science and indigenous knowledge have to be balanced. Like I mentioned, it was always the outside that was doing all the research, Western science, but they never accessed our people. So what our elders are saying, our knowledge has to be accessed. It can't just be a one-way balance here. You know, that's how it is today. It's not balanced. So in order to balance that, our indigenous knowledge must be there too. That way you'll have a balanced approach, they say.
Thank you very much, Patty.
Thank you.
That was Patty Peters of the Pecanisham First Nation in Western Ontario. He's a member of the White Feather Forestry Initiative, and he was speaking at the recent conference in Edmonton, hosted by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. The region the White Feather Forestry Initiative wishes to harvest is also home to caribou. Michael O'Flaherty is working with the Pecanisham First Nation to document the experiences of Native elders with caribou.
We've been for about 5 years now doing Indigenous knowledge interviews with the head trappers and other elders who have a lifetime of knowledge on caribou, having workshops with several of these elders focused on particular topics. We've had larger meetings which involve government representatives and outside academic partners like the University of Manitoba. And also field visits. We do field visits. And then we combine all of our data with data which the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources has gathered through aerial surveys and through ground surveys of calving islands, and try and compile a sense of where caribou are on the land. But that was only the first step. That's only the very beginning, because the knowledge that the elders have is not just knowledge about where they saw a caribou on one day when it happened to be flying overhead, but where they've seen caribou their entire life, where the caribou move, what the caribou do on the land, and how they understand these things in their own cultural point of view. So there's much more data there than can simply fit into a geodatabase and present on a map as a series of points, polylines, and lines. So we try to unpack the narrative data as best we can to develop more text-based and narrative-based results of the research, which we are just beginning to do. So it's just we've, at this point, we've done the math. We have an initial report out, but there's at least another year of developing papers for publication.
What kinds of things have the elders told you?
Lots of interesting things. Some interesting things are that they're surprised, for instance, that we're interested in caribou, in particular caribou. Why caribou? One elder said, why are we not concerned about squirrels? Squirrels are an important creature put on this earth by their creator, just as the caribou was. And squirrels should be attended to just like any other creature, and they're not quite really sure why we're focusing on caribou in particular.
What do you tell them about why you're interested in caribou?
I just tell them there is a large environmental researcher environmental NGO interest, because it's a disappearance in the landscape in the face of European habitation and development. So they're concerned now that as First Nation people engage in industrial development or new activities on the lands, they will also wipe out the caribou. But the Pikangu elders say, well, we're not interested in activities that will chase away the caribou or the squirrel, right? Or Pikangu people. We wanted to keep everybody and everything on the land as it was, as it is, as it was provided by the Creator, as it will be forever.
Is that realistic, though?
Don't know. We don't know that. No one can say that it isn't. No one can say it is, because these questions are all addressed in management planning. This, all I've reached this point is the land use strategy, which just guides future activities.
Thank you very much, Michael. Oh,
you're welcome. Thank you.
That was Michael O'Flaherty, a researcher with the White Feather Forestry Initiative. He spoke about his research at the recent Sustainable Forest Management Network conference in Edmonton. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Genome Alberta, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Advanced Education and Technology, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Kreutzer.